You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 22nd, 2010.
This is Zoe Sprinkle reporting from North Station again, waiting for my train. And today, July 16th, Friday, Rahab Farfouche presented. She at BLC today. She is a new media expert, member of President Barack Obama's social media team. And she is not originally from Switzerland. She's actually from Canada, but she's in Switzerland now.
And what an amazing talk. This is an incredible talk. I learned so much in this talk about politics, about media, about how we can be manipulated by media. And I'm definitely going to get her book, which is Yes We Did, right? And she's working on a new book, which I really want to read.
Called Misfits.
Misfits. Very, very cool. And she'll explain that in there. And for those of you listening, she was also part of the research team for Don Tapscott, Grown Digital. So, really great talk. We know you're going to enjoy it. Keep coming back here every day. We'll have a new podcast from the Building and Learning Communities workshop in downtown Boston, put on by the Ellen November Group in 2010.
It's one of those things where I thought I knew how the world worked, and it was my business, understanding the web and web literacy. And I watched her presentation and go, oh my God, I didn't know how that worked, I didn't know how that worked, what the strategy was in the Barack Obama campaign, and what McCain didn't do. And in a democracy, I just thought, if McLuhan was right in the mid-60s, and he's also from Toronto, if the media becomes more important than the message, then whoever controls the media will win. And it was just this other level of questioning that I had to go through to figure out what do we really need to teach people in a democracy where you're going to be voting in terms of being able to separate message from media. And Rahab, her analysis absolutely impressed me so much. And I know she's done research with Tapscott, Grown Up Digital, Growing Up Digital. So I knew she had this insight into youth culture on the web, and the combination of her research background and now with the World Economic Forum in Europe was just such a powerful trilogy of background that I had to invite her, and she was gracious enough to accept. So I'm so pleased to introduce Rahab Farfouche, this morning's keynote.
The first challenge is always just to make it on the stage without tripping and falling. So far, so good. Good morning. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. It is such a pleasure to be here. And frankly, such an honor to be able to talk to a room full of teachers and educators, because from my own personal experience, I would not be where I am today if it wasn't for a couple of incredible teachers that really went above and beyond and helped me with their guidance and their mentorship and their expertise. So it feels like I'm kind of giving something back, so I have a very good vibe about this talk. Could we start the... today I'm kind of giving a bit of a double feature talk, if you will, which I'm hoping will help answer some of the questions about why we should care about what the Obama campaign did with social media and what it means for education. So we're going to start off with the Obama bit. So I wrote a book called Yes, We Did, and it was really the compilation of my experiences from being a volunteer on the new media team in Chicago during the last couple of months of the campaign. And what I found really interesting was that the things that were happening, the lessons that I was learning on the campaign from a strategic perspective could be applied to a wide variety of different circumstances, including government, including education, and especially what my book focused on, business. So I'm going to share with you some of the lessons that I learned and how it can be applied. I have some examples that are more educational focused for you today. So how does a Canadian, because I am from Toronto, end up on the Barack Obama campaign? Well, it's kind of an interesting story. I was working on the research team with author Dawn Tapscott on a book called Grown Up Digital. And Grown Up Digital was the result of a multi-million dollar study that was done that was examining how young people, the Net Generation, or Gen Y, from all over the world, were using technology like social networks and blogs and collaborative platforms to really change the way that they were interacting with businesses, with educators, and with politics. And my area of focus was politics. So we were looking at things like how students in Colombia were using Facebook to organize global days of rally around the militia there. There was a student, an American student in Egypt, who was protesting, and he was arrested and picked up by the police. And before they took his phone away, he sent a one-word message to Twitter. He said, "Arrested." And his network took that message, and by the time they had arrived at the jail, they had already notified his parents, his university, the American embassy, and the American embassy actually sent over two lawyers to negotiate his release within a number of hours. So this is the speed at which technology is changing the way that young people are interacting with politics. And part of my research took me to a young man named Chris Hughes, who worked on the Obama campaign. Now, Chris Hughes is one of the co-founders of Facebook, and he was responsible for building the online community that our grassroots supporters use to organize and mobilize. I kind of stalked him for a while, and I begged him to let me interview him, which he kindly agreed. And after I learned about all the stuff that they were doing down there, I was so blown away that I begged him to just let me come down and be a part of it, and he said yes. So I was able to head down to Chicago. I packed my stuff up in a rental car. I drove all night to get there. I found a roommate on Craigslist who turned out not to be a murderer, which is always a plus. And the next thing I knew, I was working down there in the team, sort of in the hub of where everything was happening. I had a chance to just become a sponge and just to learn and see everything that was happening. There's a couple of overarching themes in my presentation, just some things to keep in mind as we go into some very specific lessons. The first is that this campaign isn't a win for technology. To say that it's a win for technology is quite misleading, because the technology, they were just tools. The McCain campaign and the Clinton campaign, they had some of the very same tools, but what was the difference was how those tools were used. This campaign was a win for strategy, and it showed the power of these tools when they were applied within an overarching digital communication strategy. The second, the strategic nugget that was really at the core of this entire campaign was this idea that online organizing has to equal offline action. Meaning that no matter what we did, whether it was on Facebook or on the blogs or through text messaging, everything was aimed to get you, the voter, to get off of your chair, out of your house, and onto the streets, do the activities that would add value to the campaign. We didn't care if you were blogging or you were on Facebook. What we cared about was, were you making phone calls, were you talking to people, were you donating money, were you organizing events? And as you'll see through some of the examples here, every single thing that we did always came down to getting people out and into the real world, doing the things that would help us win the campaign. This is also a story of consistent branding and design. When the campaign first started, the messaging, the brand, the logo, they were all over the place. And it wasn't until Scott Thomas, who was the Obama's creative director, it wasn't until he got on board that he said, listen, we're confusing people by putting signs in different fonts and fonts and signs in different colors. We're just making a mess of things. What we need is a clear message, we need a clear symbol, we need something that no matter where you going to see that symbol and you're going to recognize that it means Obama. And our brand was around the idea of hope, action, and change. Every time you saw that symbol, every time you heard the logo, every time you saw the sign, that message was reinforced. And this was a very important part. Because at the time, he was a very unknown candidate. And so it was really a matter of letting people know and introducing him to the general public. And finally, this is a story of iterations. I mean, again, when I talk to people about this, they think, well, I can never do this. Look at how complex it was. Look at how many people were doing it. Look at how many tools they were using. What people don't really realize is that this started out with one step. When it started out at the beginning, back in 2006, even 2007, they started out with one blog that eventually morphed into 50 state blogs, and then constituent blogs, and then subsequent platforms. It started out with a MySpace profile, and then a Facebook profile, and then a profile on over 17 different social networks. So don't feel like if you want to try some of these things, like you have to jump in with the intensity or the complexity of a campaign that took 2 years to build. What I'm showing you today is the result of 2 years worth of work. So remember that this is very much a trial and learn environment. The campaign would try certain things, they would see what was working and what wasn't, and they would build on that. So I like to always start just to set the context in terms of talking about money, because that's what really sets the scale for a lot of people. The McCain campaign raised $360 million over the course of the campaign. The Obama campaign raised $750 million. That is a staggering amount of money. And what's interesting, to let you know how much money was coming in and how fast it was coming in, I'm going to tell you a really quick story about what happened in September of 2008. In September of 2008, Governor Sarah Palin made a couple of remarks about the value of community organizers. She said some things that were not as nice as she probably could have been, and it really offended our online community because our community was built on this idea that regular people could go out into their neighborhoods, into their cities, and be a force of good and have a positive impact. So in response to this, campaign manager David Pluck, he ended up sending out an email saying, listen, if you want to show Sarah Palin just how much impact a community organizer can have, donate $5 or donate $10 and have your voice be heard. Within 24 hours, we have raised $10 million. Yeah, I mean, I was pretty happy. But by the end of September, that 30-day period, we had raised $150 million, which is the largest sum of money ever raised for a political organization in that period of time. And here's the interesting part. Two-thirds, or $100 million, of that $150 million came in from our online channels, came in from people donating through emails or through their text messaging or through some of the different social networks. And I mention this point because this was really the first time that a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations stood up and said, wait a minute, I didn't know that we could apply this to such a large scale. I didn't know that we could raise $150 million in 30 days. So this is MyBo. MyBo is the social network and was part of the team. This was the network that Chris Hughes built. Very simple interface. It was really the heart and soul of the campaign. It was where people signed up for an account and they were able to find events in their neighborhood, meet other people who shared their interests, and join groups, etc. To give you a couple of numbers, there were over 2 million profiles that were created over the course of the campaign. There were over 35,000 volunteer groups. These were self-created groups of people who just wanted to meet other people that were like them. Part of my job as a volunteer was to go through the list of all the groups and approve, you know, the ones that were legit. And so I saw all sorts of things. Some of my favorite ones were, I saw Dungeons and Dragon players for Obama, which I thought was kind of cool. I saw Chihuahua owners for Obama. And they were a funny one because they didn't want to be a part of dog owners for Obama. They thought that the Chihuahua owners were special enough to deserve their own groups, and we did not want to get involved in that, so we said, no problem, you can have the status. There were over 400,000 blog posts that were created. When you signed up for an account, you had the opportunity to bring in your own blog or to create a blog that was hosted on our platform. And there were over 200,000 offline events. Again, these were just, we did not organize these events. These were events that were created by people that just wanted to participate. So we saw things like a woman who dressed up as a voting machine for Halloween and went out knocking on doors to remind people to vote. There was a gentleman applied within schools about some of the things that I learned from my experiences on the Obama campaign. So the first is to redefine engagement. So this was a snapshot right here of where we stood in terms of social networking as of November 2008 compared to the McCain campaign. As you can see, we were really running circles around them, particularly in terms of video. Joe Rosbers, who's the director of new media, estimates that over the course of the campaign, supporters watched over 1 billion minutes of campaign-related footage online. So what does it mean to create new engagement opportunities? Well, if you think about the last election, or any general election, there was only a limited number of ways that you could get involved. You could donate some money, you could knock on doors, you could go down to a volunteer office and donate some of your time, you could maybe put a sign on your lawn, and that was about it. Hopefully on election day you would go out and vote. What these sites did was that they created brand new activities for people to get involved in the election process that didn't exist before. You could read the blog of a candidate and see his thoughts on an issue. You could follow them on Twitter and get up-to-the-minute status updates in terms of where they were on the road and what they were doing. You could watch videos on YouTube. You could receive emails from them. You could create content for them. You could share all of this with other people. So what it did with the use of these tools was they opened up an entirely new realm of activities and a new easy way for people to participate that didn't exist before. The second thing that this did was that this really enabled us to be where our voters were. Instead of forcing them to come to our website, or instead of having to go out in the physical world and try to track them down, these sites allowed us to access pockets of people that would have been very, very hard to track down otherwise. Barack Obama was the first politician to have profiles on over 17 different social networks, in particular ones that targeted minority communities. For example, Mi Gente, Asian Avenue, Black Planet, Faith Based, all of these different networks, we had a profile looking at somebody who was there managing that relationship so that we were where the voters are. This gave us access to a group of people that we would have had a very hard time tracking otherwise. The second thing that being in these networks did that was so important was that when somebody supported us, when somebody put the equivalent of a digital lawn sign, a lawn sign when they said, "I support Barack Obama," that was a trusted validation. That was a trusted endorsement that went out to all of their family and friends. If your cousin suddenly said, "Hey, I think Barack Obama is awesome," you'd probably go, "Huh, maybe I'm going to check it out because my cousin seems to think this guy is pretty cool, so I want to educate myself a little bit more." The research that we have done, particularly in Grown Up Digital, as well as in Wikinomics, has shown that the information that you get from your family and friends, you tend to trust at a much higher level than information that you receive from the radio or television ad or that you see on a brochure. So the fact that we were able to get your or our community's stamped approval meant that we had access to not only that candidate, not only that supporter, but we had access to that supporter's entire group of family and friends, and they became our ambassador that sent out the messages on our behalf and spread the word. And finally, it wasn't so much what these sites did individually that was so important, but what happened when they were used in unison. When they were used in unison, they created what I call a customized content distribution network, meaning that with a click of a button, I could send one piece of information instantly to hundreds of different locations. And I know Alan was talking about messaging and the importance of the access to the media, and this played a really big part because, as many of you know, in the latter end of the election, there was a ton of misinformation floating around. There was information about whether or not Barack Obama was an American citizen, whether or not he was the father of his two daughters. My personal favorite rumor that I heard was the fact that he had secretly applied for and received funding from a special scholarship funded by Al-Qaeda that paid for his law degree. So these were the information that was being shared, and these emails were going out to millions of people. And the way that we combated that, because we didn't have necessarily the same amount of access as other candidates, was we were able to do it versus these tools. When we used these tools, it allowed us to control the message, control what we said, the tone that we said it in, when we sent it to our voters. There was no middleman. We didn't need CNN to play a 30-second soundbite of the speech. We could play the entire speech. So ultimately, what this did was that this allowed us to engage directly with our voters, and it allowed us to have a big measure of control over the type of information that was shared, and that became incredibly powerful in fighting off some of these rumors. So when you're creating new engagement opportunities, just a couple of tips. Be wary of arbitrary metrics. Don't get fooled by things that you hear like, oh, this campaign has 10,000 Facebook people or 5,000 Twitter followers. These numbers don't really mean anything. Instead, focus on what I call the value add. What are those 10,000 people doing? How are they actually engaging with people? What are you getting out of it? A Facebook group, for example, and when I speak from personal experience, when we had a research group for Wikinomics on Facebook, and a group of 200 or 500 people who are engaged, who on a daily basis are answering your questions, talking to you, responding to you, really interacting with you, is 10 times more valuable than a Facebook page with 10,000 people where everybody joins once and then nobody does anything ever again. I mean, think about Facebook behavior. How many people join fan pages and then never go back and visit the fan pages ever? So we really want to focus on the value that's being created on those platforms. And to do this, you need to focus on high engagement users. Now this is really counterintuitive because when a lot of businesses or institutions start to build platforms, they want to cast a really wide net, and then they wonder why people aren't getting involved. Instead, focus on the handful, the minority of people that are so super engaged with your initiative already, that they will start creating all of this content for you, and then that will be the bait that draws more people in. I'll give you an example. So this was called Neighbor to Neighbor. This was our online phone banking tool that was used on the campaign. You logged into MyVo, you had an account, you were able to access various voter files that was a matter of public record. If you clicked on one of these, you received a script. It guided you through the conversation that you were supposed to have, whether it was trying to find volunteers or figuring out what issues were important to that person. And when you were done, you clicked a button and it sent that information over to the data gasp or to the state that was responsible for it. Now, what's interesting about this is that the majority of people did not use this tool. This tool was used by the minority or by a small section of those 2 million people on MyVo. However, that minority of people that use this tool were using it to make hundreds and thousands of phone calls every month. There were people using this tool that every week were making 1,000 phone calls. So think of the impact that one person making 1,000 phone calls every week, that's 4,000 calls a month, versus a platform with features where everyone was just kind of logging on and hanging out and not really doing the types of activities that we needed to win the campaign. We found that the people that were making the calls were increasing awareness, they were increasing the presence, they were increasing the knowledge and the know-how of this candidate, and that in turn was bringing more people into the mission, more people into the campaign, and that was a really important step. This is a site called Wikibooks. It was created in 2003. It's an open source community for free educational books that is a wiki, so anyone can edit it. It's a community of students, subject experts, educators, former educators. And what they're doing is there's over 38,000 pages of materials, including lesson plans, and they're putting together up-to-date open source textbooks that anybody can use in their classrooms for free. So what this says is if you engage that minority of people, the people that are, that maybe you have three or four subject matter experts that contribute on a particular page on biology, those people will create enough momentum that they'll bring other people in, and eventually, just like Wikibooks, you'll have a very vibrant community where people are creating content and digesting content as well. The second point is to convert your low-end users. So once you have everybody, once you have your high engagement users creating stuff, how do you get everybody else to join in? And for the campaign, we did this via email. So we sent over 1 billion emails over the course of the campaign. And you would actually be surprised to learn at how many people, once they received an email, really truly believed in their heart of hearts that they were getting an email sent just to them from Barack Obama. We would get all these messages back and be like, "Dear Barack, thanks so much for letting me know how it's going. I know you're so busy. I really appreciate the time." I mean, it was kind of amazing to me to get that. And my favorite emails were the ones where they gave him feedback. Like, "I really didn't like the tie you were wearing at that last point." And people were really engaging, but they felt as though your email was easy, it was painless, it was passive, you just clicked subscribe, and you got the messages in your inbox. The way that we made those emails valuable was we did something called hyper-segmentation. And hyper-segmentation segmentation is a technique that we use to make sure that every single email that was sent out had relevant content to the person who was reading it. Hypersegmentation basically means that you take all the characteristics of, in the database that you have from your mailing list, so where they live, their age, their income, whatever, and you group people together based on certain similarities. So we segmented people in three ways. The first, easy, was their location. If you received an email, if you lived in Florida versus if you lived in California, you were receiving two different emails. And this is because if we think back to online organizing equals offline action, every email that we sent out included a link to events that were happening in your neighborhood. This wasn't something that was happening somewhere else. The campaign was happening in your neighborhood, so we wanted you to get out and participate. The second way that we segmented stuff was based on the issues that they thought was most important to them. So if they chose education versus healthcare or social services versus foreign policy, they were going to get information just about the issues that they cared about. This was, we wanted to make sure that people were receiving news about things that they cared about, because if you're interested, you're going to open up that email from us, you're going to read it, you're going to remember the content, and you're going to pass it on. And finally, we sent emails based on donation history. When was the last time you donated to the campaign? How much did you donate? And where were you in terms of the limits of personal contributions? And this was out of respect. For a lot of households, donating $25, even $50 or $100 was a really big financial commitment. We would get notes from people with their donations. I remember reading a note from a woman who said that she was borrowing $100 from her son's college fund because she felt like this was such an important cause. So the last thing you wanted to do to somebody like this was to have them take the initiative and send you something that was a pretty big contribution for them, and then the next day have them receive an email saying, hey, why don't you support the campaign? Why don't you donate $50? We wanted to make sure that people took into account that they understood that we valued their contribution, and that no matter what, you know, how much they donated or when they donated, that it mattered and that they were a part of the team. So we collected over 13 million email addresses, and it's really about something that I call the ask versus the nudge. Why this tool was so effective was because for many people, they had never ever been involved in the political process before. Many of them had never voted before, had never filled out a voter registration card. So to all of a sudden ask them to do all of these things was quite scary. We asked a lot from our high engagement users. We asked them to host events, we asked them to donate money, we asked them to watch, we asked them to host debate parties. On the election day, we sent out emails to all of our high engagement supporters that had the names of five people that lived in their neighborhood that they didn't know, and we said, go out and make sure these people get to the polls. This was the type of commitment that we expected from our high-level users, but that would have been very intimidating for somebody who had never participated. For those people, we had nudges. A nudge is just a really small, simple action that's easy to do, that you can do online, that gets people involved. So for example, click on this link and watch this video. Donate $5. Make one phone call to somebody you know. Really easy things that just get people's feet wet in the process. And what we found was when you did it this way, the people that came in at one end of the spectrum as you know, low contributing users eventually worked their way up until they were high value users. The person that made one phone call came back and did 5, and then 10, and then 100, and then they became a precinct captain, and then they became a state desk liaison, and it really just grew. And this never would have happened if we didn't take into account that you have to build up this trust slowly, and you have to build your engagement slowly. In terms of educational nudges, one of the best ones I've seen at the University of Stanford, some of their professors offer their office hours on Facebook. So you can go online, you can ask questions, you can message and interact with your professor. And I think this is a really great way. This has become a very popular feature. Why? Because maybe it's intimidating for a student to come up and ask you a question when you're a professor. I remember my first year of university, I never wanted to go see my professor because I thought that if I asked him a question, then he would know that I wasn't fully understanding everything and he would think that I was dumb. So I was too shy and I didn't go and ask, but if this had existed, it would have been a lot easier for me to ask him a question, you know, through a virtual method, because then I feel more at ease. What they are finding with this is that people are getting more engaged. The people who are commenting on these sites are becoming more engaged in class or participating more. It's like you're easing them into it. You're easing them and making them feel more comfortable with the content and more comfortable with the environment. The third is to facilitate existing behavior. So one of the ways that we did this was with an iPhone application, and facilitate existing behavior pretty much just means that we wanted them to support us, and we wanted them to support us no matter where they were and what they were doing. And the easiest way to do that is to take the things and the tools that they were already using and to add an ability for them to use that tool to help us. This is the iPhone application for Barack Obama. It's coded for us in a couple of weeks by some volunteers. And I'll give you an example of how it facilitated existing behavior. If you were to click on this top button over here that said Call Friends, what that application would do is that it would take all of the existing phone numbers in your phone's phone book, and it would reorganize them for you using the area code and prioritize them based on the most important battleground states. So that pretty much meant that if you were only going to make one phone call, we wanted to make sure that that one phone call would have the highest impact so that you were reaching the person in the state that we needed the most help at that time. This was really cool because it allowed us to constantly change what the prioritization was, meaning that as the election evolved and as things kept moving, we could push all of these people to call states where we really needed some help. The other thing was it used the GPS to find any events that were happening near you that you could RSVP to right through your phone. Even there's a little button that said donate, so if you were so motivated and you click that donate button, we even dialed the numbers for you and connected you to somebody who was more than happy to take their financial contribution. In terms of education, these devices are really changing the way that kids are learning and kids are interacting with information. You can do everything from practice your SAT words to practice for your biology exam in terms of anatomy, to learn fractions. These are the types of tools that I think are so important because we have these devices. These devices are a natural part of our lives. And when you think of all I think of myself, I have an iPhone, an iPad, a BlackBerry, and a computer. And one of them are always with me at all times. And now, thanks to the applications and thanks to the App Store, I'm learning things. I have a Spanish application that's teaching me Spanish right now when I'm on the plane. And these are things that I don't think enough schools are taking advantage of because they're just an easy, interactive way for kids to get access to more information. The fourth is to incent the right actions. So in terms of online organizing, it was offline action. How did we make sure that the people who were participating with us were doing the activities that were going to make the most difference? So we had this thing called the Activity Index, and what it did was that it broke down all the different ways that people could participate in the campaign, and it assigned them a point value. And then that point value was used to calculate a score out of 10, 10 out of 10 being the highest and 1 out of 10 being the lowest. A couple of things about this. One, the activities that required offline action, so actually knocking on doors and hosting events, received more points. And here's the twist. The algorithm that was used to calculate the score out of 10 took into account the recency of the last time you had done an activity. What this meant was this. If last week I made 500 phone calls for Barack Obama and my score went up to 10 out of 10 and I was so excited, if this week I didn't make 500 phone calls, my score would slowly start to drop back to zero. This was something that was public, was something on people's profiles, and it became this competition as to who loved Barack Obama more. It was crazy because once people reached a 10 out of 10, there was no way that they were going to let that status drop, and they were back every day doing the offline activities that was generating their high score. Some of you might be thinking, well, who cares? Who cares if you're 8 out of 10 or like what's the big deal? Well, when you achieve a certain level of engagement, you had access to certain prizes. At the beginning stages of the campaign, 10s were given access to conference calls with Barack Obama himself. Over the course of the campaign, they offered phone calls with everybody from Al Gore to governors to organizers. What we did with this, too, is it let us know what volunteers were developing what capabilities. And we were able to hone our volunteers and to train them so that they were experts at their specific tasks. Meaning, if we saw that you were at 10 out of 10 because you were making hundreds and hundreds of phone calls, we called you up and we said, hey, you're making hundreds of phone calls. You're a really great phone banker. We want to invite you to be a part of a special task force and get special training that's going to make you even more effective at your job at making phone calls.
data or hosting events or starting groups. We were able to really pinpoint and train groups of people based on the aptitudes that they were already showing. So this is a site called Cranster, cranster.com, and what it is that it's a community of students and teachers that help each other with homework questions or homework problems. And the site is based on a system of karma points, where the more you contribute and your answers are rated by the community as to their usefulness, the more you contribute and the more you help other people out, the more karma points you get. And those karma points are redeemable for prizes such as laptops and phones and access to certain services. Again, by using karma points, we're incenting that we're not just figuring out how many times the user's logging in. We don't just want them to come to the site. We want them to come to the site and contribute something of value that's going to help another member of the community. This is a way that we're inciting the right action. Another version is called GradeFund. GradeFund.com lets children sign up, and they set a goal for how much or for what level of academic achievement they're going to achieve. So I'm going to have a B+, or I'm going to have an A. And then they get sponsored by their parents. And at the end of the year, you submit your grades, they get verified. And if you're great, if you hit your goals, you get money. Meaning your parents say, I will give you $50 or I will give you $100 if you achieve this B grade average or A grade average. And this is how it works. And you can have your entire family sponsor you. And it's something that motivates kids to participate and to learn, you know, whatever works. So these are just some of the communities around education that we're seeing that are trying to create the right standards of behavior. And in the session that's afterward, I'd be so interested to hear educators' responses to some of these, because some of the reactions, particularly towards Cranster, has been, well, you're helping kids cheat because they're just getting answers to things. And it's an ongoing debate between, well, how are we providing kids this information and what are they doing with it? The fifth is personalizing the mission. So, one of my favorite memories was I received this email one day in the general inbox of the site. It was part of my job to kind of maintain that. And it was this email that was in all caps. It was like font 40. It was red and bold. And I thought, you know, I don't know, this is probably like a crazy person email, because those tend to be my signals for such. But it said, attention CIA, attention Barack Obama, attention campaign staff. I thought, what does this guy want? It was a gentleman who had written in to us because he was very upset about something he had seen. He had seen a video clip of Barack Obama getting off of an airplane where he had his hands in his pocket as he was going down the stairs. And this guy writes, I can't believe that with everything we're worried about, including assassination attempts and, you know, the Republicans stealing the election, and all the things that could go wrong, that you're letting him go down the stairs without holding onto the railing. That is a huge safety risk, and you guys should, you know, get on that and make sure it doesn't happen again. And I thought, well, of course, I mean, why isn't he holding onto the railing? It seems kind of stupid. But the thing that really struck me was this idea that he said in the last line of the email, I'll never forget it, he said, I don't go home every single day and make phone calls so you guys can be reckless with my investment. And to me, that stands out so clear, this picture, and I called everyone over and we read this email because I thought, this was their candidate. People, I mean, being Canadian and being a little bit removed, I didn't understand how invested people had been in this and how insane, you know, that the connection that they felt and the strength of their convictions were. So it was really the first time that point really hit home, and the campaign really used that connection to drive stronger bonds within our online community. This was called the personal fundraising page, and it's really just a thermometer, very easy to do. You say how much money you wanted to raise, you could put it on your Facebook page, in your emails, wherever. Now the thing that made this interesting was that you had to specify a reason or the reasons why raising this money was important to you. So I want to raise $500 for Barack Obama because I have my son is fighting overseas and I want him to come home, or I don't have access to health insurance, or I want my kids to get a good quality of education. These stories started pouring in of all these people sharing their experiences, homes that have been foreclosed, jobs that have been lost, all of them very personal, saying why this was important to them. And what it did was that it turned the focus of support from people interacting and supporting us to people supporting each other. Because you weren't just donating $50 to the Obama campaign anymore. You were donating $50 to help your neighbor achieve her goals because she wanted to, because this was important to her. We found that the communities that used this had higher engage with each other because this was building bonds between users. And this is a cool point because many people think that social media takes away from your offline experience. They think that the more time you spend online is taking away from the time you're spending with your friends. When in reality, the research has shown that today, Facebook and Twitter are actually building offline relationships. They're strengthening relationships in the offline world. And I'll give you, in fact, there were 70,000 people used this tool and raised $30 million. So it was quite effective. This is a website, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, it's called Donors Choose, and it's kind of like Kiva.org, but around, it's around microfunding for educational initiatives, where you can browse projects of people that want funds for certain things. This particular project was an art teacher that wanted to get things like pipe cleaners and brushes and instruction paper and felt for her students and didn't have the money in her own budget. And people can donate $45 or $10 or whatever. But what I love about the site is, once the goal was attained, and once the project was done, you as the donor received a picture of the project, you received a thank you letter from the kids and from the teacher, and you were able to see where your money was going. Why I love this site is because the site takes something as abstract and as complicated as education funding and the importance of budget within the classroom, and it puts a face on it. You're not hearing, you know, a statement made from an elected official. You're reading something in the newspaper. You're seeing directly kids in your city, in your classroom, you know, or in a particular classroom that are being impacted by this, and it makes it personal, and it makes people feel connected to some of the issues around education. So the last lesson is empowering for innovation, and this one is really about getting people engaged in the participation process and getting people to contribute their own ideas and incorporating those ideas into the overall system. So MIBO had this feature called Find an Event Near You, where you typed in your zip code and you could find all sorts of events happening in your neighborhood. Initially, when this was released, it was done only for campaigns. That only official campaign events were put on the calendar. And our community said, wait a minute, you know, I want to put my events on there, I'm going to participate. And Chris Hughes said, of course, this is your site, let's open it up. They opened it up and we saw some really cool things started happening. There's a group of students that decided that they wanted to support Obama by living the Obama brand. And to them, that meant that they would go out in groups, dressed head to toe in Obama gear, and do acts of community service. That's what they wanted to do. They weren't asking people for money, they weren't knocking on doors, they were going out into their community and doing something positive. They cleaned up the local park, they tiled and retiled the former women's shelter, they held a book drive, they did a 5K walk for cancer. This is what they wanted to do. So what happened? This event went up on the screen like this. Within hours, we started to see shadow events pop up from other people who liked the idea so much that they wanted to do it in their own state. So we saw across the country, and the group called themselves Obama Works. We saw Obama Works events pop up across the country. Without our involvement, they got together and they formed an overarching national group called Obama Works, and they collectively organized a day of action where on one day, 10,000 people went out into their cities and did something good. That's how they wanted to support the campaign. Maybe us as the staff, we wouldn't have thought of that, but we let people come up with their own ideas, and this is what they came up with. We started to see volunteers coming off of the street saying, I just saw the Obama Works kids shoveling my neighbor's driveway, and if this is what it means to be a part of this movement, sign me up. Or I want to donate $20 because they, you know, this book drive that they did at my kid's school, and I think it's so important that I want to be involved. What it did was it allowed people to infuse their own personality and their own hopes and their own dreams and their own ideas into the brand without taking anything away from it. So in terms of co-innovation, I don't know how many of you are familiar or have looked yourself up on ratemyteachers.com. I would suggest you do, if you haven't done so already. It rates teachers based on their easiness, their helpfulness, and their clarity. And I mean, I think this is an invaluable tool. I mean, obviously you're always gonna have that one kid that's just gonna hate you, but if you take that outlier away, there's actually some pretty valuable feedback in terms of things that are working and things that haven't worked. This is my biology teacher, Mr. Sapochak, who is like one of my all-time favorite teachers in high school. I looked him up and found him online, and I think it's such a great tool that will really pinpoint areas of weaknesses and areas of strengths, and I think everybody should go home and kind of look themselves up on this tool. So what does all of this mean? Why is this campaign sort of such a big deal in terms of changing the way that we're interacting with technology? Well, for the first, it really had a global impact. I think it was really important because it felt as though the entire world had taken note and had said, huh, something really different just happened. Something happened here that had never quite happened before. And what it was the emergence of a new model, a new way for people to participate in the political process. If you look at the two maps comparing 2004 and 2008, I mean, literally, some of the areas of the United States were redrawn. I mean, New Mexico, Colorado, Florida, Virginia, North Carolina, I mean, some of these states, you know, this was the quantifiable difference of a mobilized army of millions of people. And that the model was so stunning because, one, it showed that technology could mobilize people at an unprecedented scale around an issue such as politics. But two, it really showed that these new changes that happen so fast can take years of campaign strategy and tactics that have worked in the past and turn them completely on its head. And that's really the key here, is that the pace of innovation and the pace of this technology is changing the way that we're interacting with each other is happening so fast that a lot of institutions just aren't prepared. And there are systems in place that don't really make any sense anymore. And it's this gap between institutions and people and what this means for teachers that I'm really interested in exploring. And it's really the subject of my new book, which is called Misfits, How We've Outgrown the Way We Live. Now, I'm co-authoring this with a good friend of mine, Leonard Brody, and I'm just sharing with you some of these ideas because we've just started the research phase. And I want to share with you some of the things that we're working through and thinking about, and I'd love to hear any of your feedback and any of your reactions to how the educational system, how we're outgrowing some of the aspects of our educational system. So I want to start off with a quick story about monkeys. Now, there's this research experiment where researchers placed 5 monkeys in a cage. And in the cage, they put a banana that was hung by a string and a stepladder. And every time one of the monkeys tried to go get the banana, it would get sprayed with cold water. The rest of the monkeys would get sprayed with cold water. So monkey A would try to go get the banana, all the other monkeys would get sprayed with cold water. Eventually, they all learned that going to the stepladder was unacceptable behavior, and any monkey that attempted to go to the stepladder was attacked. And they learned, no stepladder, no banana for anybody, we don't like the cold showers. So what the researchers did, once this behavior was completely learned, was they took away the cold water, and they took away one of the original monkeys, and they replaced it with a new monkey. The new monkey sees the banana, but before he can get the banana, he just gets attacked by everybody. And he's confused, he doesn't really know what's going on, but he learns if you go to the stepladder, you're gonna get attacked. So the researchers start replacing all the original monkeys with new monkeys until eventually the group of monkeys is a completely new one. None of them have ever experienced the cold water shower firsthand, and yet they have learned this behavior that they are going to continue to fight and beat up anybody that tries to go to the stepladder. And well, the punchline for this joke is this is how corporate policies are formed, which I totally agree with on so many levels. But really, why I love this story so much is because it illustrates that sometimes we put rules in place that make a lot of sense at the time, but then circumstances change, we evolve, but the system doesn't. And that's really what I'm seeing happening, not just in education, but in business and in government. We're starting to see that we as people are starting to act in different ways and think in different ways, but we're struggling and we're banging up against these events and these systems that have been in place for decades. So let's look at education. This is something called the Current Educational Pipeline, and it was research that was done by Professor Nicholas Allen, who is, I think it's called the University of Maryland College. And he describes this as the current state in terms of what's happening in the education pipeline today. What is the system that is kind of ruling or the philosophy around education? So education is oriented to, you have to participate full-time, for full-time enrollment, usually aimed towards residential students. It's quite age-specific. It's largely homogenous because you're going to school with around people who usually in the same proximity as you, meaning the same socioeconomic factors. It's front-loaded, meaning at the beginning of your educational career in elementary school, you're doing a lot of hours of school, and then that eventually, once you get to university, the number of hours decreases. And this is the system that we're kind of dealing with today. It's a system that has made sense for decades. It has made sense for a really long time. But what is happening in the world is that there are demographic shifts that are happening that are making this system no longer fit the people it is intended to help. When you look at education stats in the US alone, the emphasis, particularly in higher education, universities and colleges and postgraduate programs, is an emphasis on traditional students, 18 to 22 years old, full-time, having to go on campus. Here's the interesting thing. There was a research study that was done that showed that out of a survey of 17 million people who were enrolled in postgraduate or secondary degrees, only 16% of them fit the criteria or the profile of traditional students. Only 16%. We're starting to see shifts where people want different experiences with their education. For example, over 58% of students are over 22 years of age in higher education. 40% of them are over the age of 25. 40% of them are part of part-time programs, and 40% of them are attending two-year programs at various schools. We're starting to see that the future growth will continue to favor non-traditional students because there's also been a huge skyrocket in online enrollment. Schools are reporting that there are more popular options, even things like hybrid MBAs where you go in for 2 week intensive periods and do the rest virtually are starting to become much more popular. And these are the things that are starting to tell me that people want a different experience than they're currently getting. I look at my own self, I would love to go back to school for like a master's degree or something, but the current system just doesn't fit my life. I don't want to put my life on hold for 2 years and go learn. Why can't I do it virtually? Why can't I do it from a distance? Why can't I do it on an ongoing basis? These are the questions that I'm asking myself, and I'm assuming a lot of other people are asking too. In terms of global demographic information, the global populations are growing at such a rate that most institutions can't keep up anyway. There will be over 200 million students globally by 2020, which is double the amount that there is today, which is 100 million students. There are 30 million students under the age of 20 worldwide who are qualified to be in school but don't have access to the bricks and mortar building. They don't have access to the physical place to go and learn. Ultimately, they estimate there's a report that came up about the future of online education that said that in order for universities to meet this demand, one new major university would have to open up every single week to be able to anticipate the load of students and the demand for learning. So bricks and mortar isn't going to cut it anymore. The current system needs to change, or at least evolve a little to take into account some of what's happening with people. I'll share some more detailed information in the next session, specifically around, we have two major things happening in the US population right now, the increase of an immigrant population, as well as the baby boomers who, instead of retiring, are going for what is being called encore careers. And these encore careers is pushing the age of retirement, and they are not, they want to go back to school for that, so that's putting different strains on the educational system. There's a lot of changes that are happening right now, and now is the time to really take note and to figure out how we can meet some of this demand. So ultimately, technology is changing the way that we think, and I do want to just make a quick point here, which is the magic of technology isn't the fact that you can put your lecture notes online or that you can have a study meetup on Skype. It's the fact that the existence of technology is changing the way that we think. It's changing the way that students are problem solving, that they're interacting with information, and that they're searching for information as well. One of the ways is instant gratification. Thanks to my devices, I have access to Google at any point, anywhere, meaning if I have a question about anything, I can look it up. This is changing the way students view the availability of information. Now, the thing that we're talking about in the book or that we're researching is, if we can access all this information all the time, everywhere, does it make sense to have tests that are more around the idea of regurgitating information rather than critical or analytical problem solving? We don't know, don't shoot the messenger, but maybe this is one of the things that we need to look at, which is how are we testing kids and what are we testing them for? Is it still the same value as it was before? The second thing is it's really having a rich multimedia experience. And this is, it's really interesting because when you think of students, and even think of teachers, people in the regular world, we have devices, we're interacting with knowledge, and then you go into the classroom and it's like there's this bubble. You're cut off from all the normal avenues that you're used to in every other part of your life. I don't really read physical newspapers anymore, or because I think they're an intellectual dead end. find them boring. I read the physical newspaper, I get to the end of the story, and if I have questions, if I want to learn more, I can't do anything. Versus when I read something on my computer, I see a hyperlink, I click on it, I learn more, I go to a picture, I see a speech, I go to a YouTube video, I go on this informational journey that's customized to what I want and what I want to learn. I mean, I have spent hours sometimes getting lost on Wikipedia because I started off wanting to learn about something and then I end in a completely different place. And I mentioned to Alan in the interview that I did for this conference, how many kids do you know get lost in like the Encyclopedia Britannica? You know, how many people are like, I picked up, you know, the letter B and it was so fascinating. I mean, this is an opportunity. People, it's an opportunity to get people excited about learning. And I think it's one that's really fun. I'll tell you a fun game that you can play with your students, because my friends and I play it. It's called the Wikipedia Hunt. And what it does is that you pick your entry point into Wikipedia and then your exit point into Wikipedia, and then you tell your friend to try to see if they can get from point A to point B on the site. So one of my friends sent me one, started out with the drug cartel in Colombia and it ended up with like Daffy Duck. And it was like, how can I go to Wikipedia and how can I navigate through the information to get from, you know, one to the other? This is, we're learning information and there's so many opportunities that exist right now. In terms of information, the other thing that's really interesting that we're finding is traditionally, schools have been built around the idea that information is this finite thing, and once you have, you know, the capacity, whatever is appropriate for your grade, for your level, then you've mastered that amount of information. When really, if you think about it, information is growing at a fluid and insane rate. No one person can ever be, you know, an expert on anything anymore. And this, we need to change the way that we're teaching kids, because it's no longer about acquiring a set amount of information. It's about having the necessary skills to go into this chaotic, fluid, continuously growing amount of space and figure out how to sift through all of that information and get what you want. This is a time-lapse video of the Wikipedia page that was created after the US Airways flight 1549 crashed into the Hudson River. This happened within seconds of the crash. There are sources, and it's hard to see, but there are sources that are being added. There's a picture on Twitter that's going to be added in a second. And this is just happening across Wikipedia all the time. This is how news is formed. This is how information is being formed. And it gets more and more, and so the picture gets added now. So now, all of a sudden, if you go to this page, you're not just reading about an article about a plane crash. You can click and get access to information about US Airways, about the pilot, about other crashes, about the Hudson River, about the geese. We're no longer following information in a linear way. Each information point has become a web that launches you into an infinite amount of other information webs. And I think the educational system really needs to start adapting to that policy. So this really brings me to one of the last concepts, and I've talked to you at you all for a long time, so I am wrapping up. It's really called the new literacy. And what the new literacy is what are we going to teach kids in school now that this is the environment that they're learning in? And I just want to make a quick point that oftentimes we seem to mistake technical aptitude for like technical genius. And we think that just because kids know their way around the web and know how to use all these tools, that they're going to make the right choices and that they have the ability to critically assimilate information. That's not true. I think a better example would be to think of it as, you know, if you have a child that's musically inclined. So if you have a child that's musically inclined, who can play notes by ear, who can tool around and figure things out, that doesn't mean that they don't need practice. That doesn't mean that they don't need music theory. That doesn't mean that they don't need someone to show them technique. That doesn't mean that they don't need their skills refined. And that is what we need to do with kids and the new literacy. I remember in grade 6, we had a course in class one day. Our teacher taught us how to read the newspaper, because we were doing a unit in social studies or something around current events, and we had to bring a newspaper to class, and we sat there, and our teacher taught us, this is how you go through it, and this is where you find the sort of things that you're looking for, and et cetera, et cetera. We need to teach kids how to wade through this information, because otherwise they're going to get swept away, and like Alan said, they're going to get convinced by messaging and by tricks and by gimmicks that are just going to harm us as a democratic world or a democratic. One of the things we need to teach them is how to leverage online communities. How do you build systems, and how do you build digital support systems when you're dealing with personal problems, when you're dealing with school problems, when you're dealing with home problems? We need to teach them how to critically evaluate information. With now everyone can publish whatever they think with a click of a button, the defining lines between opinion and fact are becoming more and more blurred. So how do we teach kids to question everything that they read and to say, huh, who is saying this? Why should I believe them? What does this tell me about the issue? Where can I go to verify this information? These are skills that have to be taught. They're not something that can just be assimilated naturally. Understanding messaging. We don't want the next president of the United States to be elected only because he had a really good feel-good motto and some slick YouTube videos. We need to push people to look behind the messaging, look behind the tools, and really figure out what is going on here. How is this impacting our life? Where can I find the answers that I'm looking for? And ultimately, it's really about triangulating the truth. I think before it was something, the responsibility of figuring out what happened, we placed on newspapers. We would turn on the news and we would have somebody tell us what the issue is. Now there's so many voices, that's no longer the case. Now there are so many voices that you have to go in there and you have to see a perspective of people, a wide array of people with different stances on different issues. And then you ultimately have to figure out, okay, how can I figure out what's happening? How can I make my own conclusions? And finally, there's going to be a concept around digital citizenship. We have been taught to consume and consume and consume, but we're in an age right now where people should be giving something back. We shouldn't just, why is it that only 2% of people contribute to Wikipedia and 98% benefit from it? We need to teach our kids that part of being a digital citizenship, or part of being a digital citizen, is giving back to the community, is participating in a value-adding way, and being a positive force on the web. The challenges for educators, you guys have one of the hardest jobs, and it's the most important job, and it's changing completely. Everything that used to be so is kind of shifting at this very moment. You're learning in parallel to your students, for one thing. You need to learn how all of these tools work and what the impacts are, and then sometimes your students know a little bit more than you, and that is changing the playing field as well. Teachers used to be the gatekeepers of knowledge. They had all this knowledge, they gave it to you, you took it, and went on your merry way. And now their role is evolving to be more of a facilitator, to look at different areas of knowledge and different opportunities and see how can I get kids the knowledge that they need, even if I don't have it, maybe another student has it, or another teacher has it, or a website has it, and you become a guide and a facilitator and a participant, one of the learners in this process. And ultimately, I do wanna say that it's about your perspective, because all of this technical stuff, nothing really can be compensated for life experience. Has anybody ever heard of FormSpring? So for those of you that don't know, it's a social network that popped up where you can ask questions and get anonymous answers. And for some reason, it became really big with the preteens and the young teenagers who used it to write awful, awful things about each other anonymously. You're fat, you're ugly, nobody likes you, you have no friends, why do you even come to school? I mean, the list went on and on. And I read an article about a teacher who started noticing that her kids were getting increasingly distressed. There were fights, there was tensions, and she couldn't figure out what was going on. Until one day she figured out FormSpring, she went on it, and she learned about it. And the next day she had a talk with her class about cyberbullying. This is an educator that had been in this space for years, and as a teacher, I'm sure she had seen all different forms of bullying, whatever the method of delivery, bullying is still bullying. And because she had that life experience, she was able to sit her kids down and say, look, this is a form of bullying. Here's what you can do. Here are the things you need to watch out for. And here's when you should ask for help and where you can go for help. And then the comment at the end of the article said that, a kid came up to her and said that they didn't know that that was called cyberbullying because they thought bullying was when someone shoved you in the hallway. They didn't realize that having someone post attacking comments on you online is a form of bullying. So you have the experience, you have the perspective, you can understand why if somebody in high school posted pictures of them binge drinking, why in a few years when they're trying to get into school that might be problematic, or when they're trying to get a job that might be problematic. You have that longevity and that opinion that other people that, when you're young and you're a kid and you're doing things, you just don't know. So some final thoughts. The time is really now. It's so exciting. We're in what we call the pixelated revolution, and everything is changing, and I think it's changing better. It is okay to be uncomfortable. Some of these things require changes in plans and changes in the way that things have been done. Don't fall into the monkey trap. Don't be scared just because it's always been done that way that it can't be done any differently. It is a trial and error system. Nobody really knows what the the best practices are, and the best practices themselves are emerging and evolving and changing. And finally, my last thought is really to focus on relationships. And I tell this at all my talks and to all my clients, don't get carried away with the shiny aspect of this new tool or this new gimmick or this new gadget. Fundamentally, all these tools have one value, and that's to connect people and to build relationships with people. So as long as you look at each tool and you say, how can this make me a better teacher? How can this help me help my students? Where are the opportunities here for knowledge interaction and new systems? I'm sure that you will meet every single challenge head on and with much success. Thank you so much.
That worked. Students are, we're asking them to come to us. So with that, we'll change over.